Today I have the pleasure of introducing Amy Richards. Amy is the author of Manifest, Grassroots, and Opting In. She is a creator of the Third Wave Foundation and a founding board member of the Sadie Nash Leadership Project and Fair Girls. And she also serves on the board of Chicken and Egg Pictures, great name, love it, Feminist.com, and other organizations that prioritizes girls and women. She has been involved in numerous organizations and numerous film productions, including the HBO documentary, Gloria, in her own words, Makers, Women Making America, and Scenarios, USA. Amy graduated cum laude from Barnard College, as I did, small world, and lives in New York City. So now it's my pleasure to turn the podium over to Amy, and I hope you enjoy her wonderful remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. When I heard Ruth say that she was going to retire, I want to say I'll wait and see, because I've yet to see one woman who successfully retires. Women just move on to the next adventure. Yeah. But thank you for that introduction as somebody who was a brownie but never made it to be a Girl Scout. And it's great to be here. I'm actually from Massachusetts, and so even though I've lived in New York longer than I lived in Massachusetts at this point in my life, coming to Massachusetts feels like coming home. And so thank you for welcoming me home and being a part of today. After the AV people just worked their hardest to get today started, thank goodness for the delay, because we needed that extra 15 minutes, but I'm going to try to keep this on time. I want to start and tell you a little bit more about who I am and how I came to be who I am, and then introduce to you a program that I've been a part of called Makers, Women Making America, which is both a three-hour documentary that aired on PBS last February and is going to have a continued life on PBS in 6 one-hour series, but is a permanent online platform of now over 200 women's stories. And they're great stories, and you can return to them again and again. And so for starters, I mean, I look out at this audience and I see so many young women, and Ruth said women, and I was like, there's not one man, really? I don't think I've ever given a lecture that's all women, even when it's been in single-sex schools. There's always one custodian or teacher or somebody in the room. But so the, you know, for me, I look out at this audience and I see myself. And I see myself of who I was when I was 15, 16, and 17. And in many ways, I'm the same person. You know, even though you get older and grayer and saggier, you still, and more tired, you still are that same person. And you know, when I was 15, 16, 17 years old, I went to a private school in Massachusetts, and it had just gone co-ed. And I got to feel really special because I was one of the first girls, and I got to be the captain of the soccer team, and I got to be one of the only girls in the physics class, and I got to be a girl, you know, I got to be the girl in the AP calculus class, and I got to feel very singular, I thought. And what I realized, that as much as that was a treasured place to be in some ways and a supportive place to be, it was also very alienating, because what happened in my generation is that only one woman was allowed. And I mean, I think that's even more true as I look at Ruth and her generation. And so it took me a number of years to realize, like, oh, wait, being the only isn't good. We should be many. And it was not until I got to a very comfortable setting like Barnard College, which is all women, where I got to realize the value of being in single-sex settings and how much more than one woman should be in the room. And when I got to Barnard, it was actually very intimidating for me at first, because I was used to being very singular, and I was like, oh, I'm Amy, I'm well-spoken, and I've worked for Ted Kennedy, and I've traveled, and then I met all these other people who were like, oh, I have a Ford Grand, I've already lived in Honduras for 4 years. I was like, what? I thought it was just me. But I realized how great it was to have a community where you could support each other and not feeling like it had to just be you. And so that journey of being singular to being part of a community is, I think, that's something that all of us go through. And hopefully there are fewer and fewer opportunities where you're the only one today. That said, I do know that there are still some experiences, even when there's many in the room, it doesn't mean it's necessarily a friendly room or a friendly space all the time for girls and women. When I was your age, I thought I was going to grow up and be, when I was about six, I thought I would grow up to be the first female president of the United States, but let's hope Hillary Clinton beats me to that. And then I thought that I wanted to be a lawyer or a politician. And then I arrived at college and thought, okay, I have to major in political science, I have to major in history, and that's how I'm going to be there. I had a great advantage of working in a law firm my first year in college as an intern, and there were two women partners who were in their 40s who had been married and had what I think many would say were wonderful lives. And they got to a certain point in their lives and their husbands left them and they didn't have a job and they didn't have great advanced degrees and they were really depressed. But they went back to law school and they got their law degrees in their 40s and they started this amazing law practice. And so I looked from that earliest age and I thought, oh my gosh, I could do it now and then I could do it again. I could become something else when I was 40. I also realized that none of them, even though they all became lawyers, none of them majored in political science. None of them majored in history. They all did what they wanted as undergrads and then eventually went to law school. And it was a great early moment for me, one, to realize that you can reinvent yourself, and two, to realize that you could study something in college that didn't necessarily set you up to what you wanted to be, a direct route to what you wanted to be later in life. And I hold on to that over and over and over again. The other thing that was more subtle that I picked up when I worked in the law firm is the law firm specialized in divorce. And a lot of what I picked up on was how women were still very dependent upon men and how women's lives were often shattered when they got divorced because they didn't have the authority and the autonomy in their lives. And so the other thing that I picked up on was always make your own living. Always be able to take care of yourself. And again, that was a very valuable lesson for me. That said, I'm a daughter of a single mother. I've never met my father to this day. My mother left him when she was 19 years old. And even though I had her example, I needed this much bigger swath of people to say, oh, you're right, I've got to take care of myself. Not that you can't have people help to take care of you, but you really need to make sure that you're taking care of yourself. And those three tangibles have really stayed with me for the rest of my life. Now, I also often get up when people say, what do you do for a living? I say, I'm Amy, I'm a feminist activist. And then it's usually a conversation stopper before it's a conversation starter. And I've learned now to walk into the room and say, well, tell me what you do, and then I'll tell you what I do. But I feel like I'm also good proof that if you can make a living as a feminist activist, you can make your living at anything. And I didn't set out to be a feminist activist. I was in my senior year of college. I was an art history major. By that point, I thought I was going to go work full-time at Christie's Auction House, where I'd been an intern, and sell magnificent paintings and hang around in fancy cocktail dresses. And in the midst of this, there were two things, political events that happened that year. One was something called the Anita Hill, one that gets remembered as the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas hearings. And the other was the Rodney King verdict. And both of these were very racially charged moments in our history. And it was the first time where I looked and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't, by witnessing these and not doing something, I'm participating. And so I need to be part of the solution so I'm not part of the problem. And this led me on a voter registration drive, which then became the Third Way Foundation. And it was my first moment of making up my career. I think until that point, I thought that you had to send your resume, get a job, get accepted for the job, get your recommendations. And it was my first moment of making it up. And what was shocking to me is that I was able to make it up. I was able to sort of start with one thing and then build to another and then build to the next and build to the next. And the Third Way Foundation led me to being a writer, and then the writing led me to being a speaker, and then the speaker led me to starting my own company, and starting my own company led me to be a consultant to film producers. And I use that example of myself because I think it's really important to know that if it does not exist, you can build it, you can create it. And why I wanted to spend today talking about who you want to become rather than what you want to become is because I still think that we have very limited imagination. When somebody says, what do you want to do in life and who do you want to be, we tend to narrow it to a very limited number of career choices. And I think I would even guess that those career choices become even more limiting for women than they do for men. Even though we've had incredible advancements, that there still is some limiting that or self-selecting that happens. And so I think there are three things that still stand in our way when it comes to imagining. One is the examples. We don't have a lot of examples of people doing different things. And Billie Jean King, who's one of the people that's in the Makers documentary, says, and other people say a version of this, is you can't be it if you can't see it. And so it's really important to show over and over again the myriad of ways that women are doing their professional lives. And similarly, to know that men are making career sacrifices for their family as much as women are, and to expose that as well. The other thing that I think stands in our way is what I was just alluding to, is imagination. That I think we only imagine the five jobs that we're told over and over again. You can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, you can go into medicine, you can go into the nonprofit sector, but there's so much more out there. And we are on the verge of even more career opportunities, and so we have to imagine what is possible for us. And then I don't want to deny that I do think, and particularly for women, there's still some, what all stands in our way is there's still some restrictions. There are still some societal restrictions that make it possible for us to be who we want to be or who we fully want to be. And so I'm hoping that this generation can usher past those remaining hurdles. The Makers documentary touches on a lot of these examples. And I don't know how many people have seen Makers or heard of Makers or... Oh, good. Okay, well, that's good. Okay, well, hopefully by the end of today, you'll all go back and watch more of Makers. And there are, you know, Hillary Clinton, when she was 16, she wrote to NASA to say that she wanted to be an astronaut. And they wrote back to her and said, I'm sorry, you can't, you're a girl. And when Oprah Winfrey was hired in her first job in Baltimore doing newscasting with a male counterpart, she found out that he was making twice what she was making. And when she went and asked her boss why that was so, he said, well, he has to pay a mortgage and he has to take care of a family. Do you have to do that? And she said no, and she accepted it. And so I think that we, the Makers is filled with examples of people who, I think what you'll see is, and Hillary Clinton initially said, oh yes, women can't be astronauts, okay, I'll check that off my list. I'm just gonna accept that I'm gonna make more money. But what did you see over time? They stopped taking no for an answer. They started saying that no's not good enough. And I think that that's where we have to keep continuing imagining. Just because people said it hasn't existed before doesn't mean that it can't exist. The Makers Project, I'll just back up a little bit, it is this three-hour documentary that chronicles women in America, and then it's also these profiles that are shown in three-minute increments. And I'm going to start and show you one by this woman, Christy Haubiger, who I really enjoy, and she was the creator of Latina Magazine, and she'll tell you all that. Because of the technical issues, I'm going to show you one video and then the next video. And then the second video is Marissa Mayer, who is now the CEO of Yahoo and started at Google. And then after I show these, I'll tell you a little bit more about why I like them and why I like this. But now I have to figure out how to do this. Okay.
Stories. I wanted to change the complexion of the newsstand. For a lot of people, we were the first magazine to put them on a cover. And now you see women like Jennifer Lopez and Salma Hayek, and you think, that's not just Latina beauty, that's what American beauty looks like. I love having some small hand in changing the notion of what American beauty looks like. My parents told me I could be anything, that a young Latina could do anything. But I didn't see images in the media and stories that were consistent with what my parents were telling me. I didn't see a lot of people like me succeeding. I have a vague memory of like seeing Char on the Love Boat. Once a year, West Side Story, you're grasping at like three or four television moments a year. I remember reading all these teen magazines and feeling really unattractive and left out. My friends who are African American had grown up reading their mother's copy of Essence magazine, which was the largest magazine for African American women in the United States. And I always thought it was amazing that there was nothing like that but for us. I basically did a class project and wrote a business plan for a magazine for Hispanic women that I completely based on Essence magazine. And I thought, well, great, maybe I'll try and start a magazine when I graduate, and if I fail miserably, I can be a lawyer. I didn't know how hard it would be, which is fortunate. When I was trying to raise money to start Latina, I had about 15 minutes with Ed Lewis, who was like my hero, who 30 years before had started Essence magazine. I came in with a business plan and I said, there are going to be more Hispanic women in this country than African American women in about 20 minutes. And we haven't had a magazine yet. We put together a partnership. We launched the magazine in 96. We put on the first cover this young rising star named Jennifer Lopez, who we thought might be the next big thing. To see her face on the newsstand with everybody else, I was like, wow, we look just as good. I was like, wait, we actually look better. Jennifer reappeared on the cover a number of times early on. There were so few Latinas who were famous. The reaction to the magazine launching was wonderful. I mean, just the letters, from the really inspirational, my gosh, I never knew there was a Latina astronaut, to I'd never seen makeup tips on someone with my skin color. The consumers were there long before the advertisers, which makes the business really tough. I knocked on all of these doors, the makeup companies, the automotive companies. I heard the most incredible objections, the same stereotypes and the lack of positive images of Hispanic women informed their view of who we were. I had people ask me, do you think your readers can afford our product? You're selling a $5.99 lipstick at Walgreens. Like, I know a lot of poor people, they all have lipstick. We can show you the research. Have you ever seen a Latino without lipstick on? Ever? One time I had a really good day in Detroit. I'd gone to see General Motors and Chrysler and Ford, and they were all stepping up and advertising in the magazine for the first time. I felt so triumphant, and I went back to my hotel. I was, you know, wearing a suit like this, and I went down the hall to get a bucket of ice. A woman stopped me in the hallway and said, oh, wonderful, dear, are you bringing those to all the rooms? I thought of like 10 really good things to say when I got back in the room. But at the time, all I could say was, no, ma'am, just my room. Of course, she walks away puzzled. And I'm trying to decide, should I go back and polish off the mini bar? Or, no, you know what? I need to get back to work. Because until that woman sees me and thinks, wow, that looks like an entrepreneur. Or I bet that's a lawyer. Until that woman sees me and thinks that, we're not done yet. Friends joke that I'm like a sleeper cell in Hollywood. I've infiltrated the system. You can't be what you can't imagine. I wanted to change the images of Latinas in this country so that other people could see the full diversity and complexity of who we are, but also so that we could see who we are.
Okay, that was Christy. You know, and she has this amazing job now at Creative Artists, and then in between went to work for a film production company. And somebody says, oh, how did you keep making those career leaps? And she says, I didn't make career leaps. I've been changing the narrative on what it means to be an American. I'm just doing it in a different medium. And I think that that's true. It's a matter of how other people describe you, and then there's how you have the ability to describe yourself. The next here is Marissa Mayer. This is just a short clip.
I was choosing between 14 different offers, and they were across all kinds of different sectors. And I said, well, why don't you think about the best decisions you've ever made and see if they have anything in common? So I made a list of the best decisions I had ever made. They were all really different, but they all had two things in common. One, I always chose to work with the smartest and most interesting people I could find. And two, I always did something I was a little not ready to do. And I remember in each case thinking, wow, like what have I really gotten myself into? But I found that if you push through that feeling of being scared, that feeling of taking a risk, really amazing things happen.
You know, Marissa also says in her interview when she got to Stanford University, I mean, not only did she have 14 jobs to choose from, she also had like 12 colleges to choose from. And when she got to Stanford, she spent her first semester there and then went back to her friends from her hometown, and they all were scattered at different colleges. And she realized that no matter where they were studying the same thing. And so she said, I'm going to go back to Stanford and study something that I can only study at Stanford. And then that's what led her into what became a computer science degree. But I think that that can happen even if you don't want to be a computer scientist, is what is this unique place going to be able to afford me that no other place can? And clearly it worked for her, so maybe it would work for the rest of us. But you know, getting back to the theme of what, of who we want to be, not what we want to be, I think it's, you know, as I said, it's been many years since I've been your age, but I get a great privilege of running these feminist camps in New York City that happen once a week, three or four times a year. And so I get to spend a lot of weeks with people who are on the verge of their careers or on their college choices. And over again, I hear this sense of like what I want to be. And then in the other part of my life, I'm dealing with makers. And you have people like Sandra Day O'Connor and Condoleezza Rice and amazing women who've accomplished tremendous things. Rarely are they doing the thing that they thought they were going to do. Rarely does it work out in that very linear way. And so I'm always sort of trying to spread the message of the one to the other group and to say, don't think about what you want to do in 40 years. Think about what you want to do tomorrow. Think about what you want to do today and think about how you can do that uniquely. And I also think, and I really hear this resonating with a lot of the women and makers, is this who. And the who is, who do you want to be? Do you want to be somebody who's changing society, changing the world? Do you want to be the primary breadwinner? Did you grow up going to summer camp and you want to make sure that you, if you have kids, they have that opportunity? Do you want to be somebody who's on the cutting edge of scientific research? Do you want to be somebody who just does a really good job at whatever you want to do? Do you want to be somebody who's out there innovating? Do you want to be somebody who's out there who's having somebody else tell you what to do? You know, we all have different personalities and we all have different things that we're good at, and we all, thank goodness, don't have to be the same thing. And thank goodness that we can all bring our unique skill sets to what we're going to do and what we're going to be. That said, I do want to acknowledge that I think women and girls have a very tough standard. I think that for girls and women, and makers is unfortunately guilty of this, that the examples we're given are of women being excellent, of women being supreme, of women being above and beyond. And I think that that's an unfair and really tough mandate. And so I feel like I've tried to make it my job to say, just be good enough. I think that men are allowed to be good enough. They're allowed to be managing director, whereas women have to be president. You know, when men are allowed to be, I'm working ad sales, whereas women have to be the publisher. And I think that we have to allow ourselves to be good enough at our jobs, and to strive to that place of excellence is unfair to us, and I think it's unfair to all women and to all men. And so what is the good enough going to be for us? And I think the good enough for most women is really looking at some balance in life. And I don't mean the traditional like work-life balance, like work and family balance. I mean, many women that I know want balance between being challenged in their jobs and using their job to challenge society. Many women I know want jobs where they can work really, really hard, and then when they have a sick parent, they can take time to take care of that sick parent. They want to be able to be a really good friend to their friends and to their you know, childhood friends and their adult friends, and they also want to be able to grow and change in their career jobs and not be stuck in the same pattern. And I think that we are finally at a time in our work-life situation, I mean, how the workplace looks, where it can finally accommodate a little bit more of a female sensibility, where you can now bring those multiple selves into the workplace and they can be seen as assets rather than being seen as deficits. That said, I will admit that there are many times when I don't define myself as a mother in professional settings because I feel like it might be used against me. It might be used to say, oh, well, then she's going to leave early, or that's not going to, we can't ask her to do something on Saturday. And I'm mostly resentful because I know that the same isn't often being asked of my male peers. It's not being asked of them, whether or not they're parents. So I want to acknowledge that I do think there are still limitations, but I think a lot of what is before us is an opportunity to bring our own imaginations and our own selves to what our careers will look like. In terms of the who, how we get to this who, I think is obviously the big challenge. And, you know, it's being stated over and over again that you have to find a mentor or a sponsor. And in the makers profiles, it almost to a T, every single person, without even being prompted by this question, has one person who made a big difference in their life. A teacher, a parent, a neighbor, an older sibling, a person that worked down the street. Find that one person. That person is probably already in your life, and find them and just sort of say, how did you get to where you're going, and would you help me and lead me on this direction? The other thing that I hear that in over and over again in the makers is that people want to help you. They want to help, you know. I mean, Oprah can't help everybody, but I do think the people come across her, she wants to help. And people want to see women in particular, but also men, being able to realize their dreams. And so the asking isn't just to benefit you. The asking is going to benefit them because they need to see what is on the hearts and minds of people who they are working with and who are leading not only in this generation, but in the next generation. One of the other things I see, and I don't know if you experience this, but I hear a lot of people who talk about the millennial generation and younger generations as being selfish and self-centered and only into themselves. And for me, I'm a little bit like, well, thank goodness. Like, we should be a little bit more selfish, and we should be a little bit more entitled. I mean, I hear it specifically when it comes to women's rights. So they're so entitled, they just take advantage and not realize what a struggle it was. I think it's important to know that there was a struggle to get a lot of the rights that I think we all have access to today. But I think take advantage of it. I think the best contribution that we can make to society is to actualize the rights that were fought for in another generation. So be the person that somebody wasn't allowed to be in another generation. Fight for something that somebody in a generation was not allowed to fight for. And you'll have your own battles, but you don't have to live from somebody else's experience. Live from your own experience. And I also think, and you know, Ruth alluded to this, is help others. And I don't mean, you know, donate money. We should do all of those things, take care of people, be good citizens. But be good to people. You know, I think, and this goes back to the singularity of women. When you're the only woman in the room, sometimes you take advantage of that specialness. But extend that specialness. Be generous with what contacts you have. You know, extend them. And you will be surprised. I'm surprised at how many people who have worked for me, basically who I now work for. And, you know, you never know when you're going to re-intersect in people's lives. And the range of people that help me on a daily basis are people who have, we have shared all sorts of work patterns. So be kind and be generous to others, and I guarantee it will come back to you. One last thing I want to say, and then I want to turn this conversation onto you. And I know there's people in the other room, and if they have questions, hopefully they can write them down, and somebody will come in and check on them, and they can bring them into this room. But before I say that, I just want to say that as much as I do think that there are still limitations that hold us back, I do think that we hold ourselves back more than anything. And when I don't know how people have heard of Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In. I actually think that there's only so far women are going to lean in, not because they don't want it and they don't desire it, but I think that we have something in us that makes us want to be more complete people, and I think that our work lives don't allow us to be those complete people. And so I think that we have to challenge ourselves. Not only should we adapt to situations that are familiar, but we have to start adapting the situations to us. It's not just that we have to go into the workplace and be a woman in that workplace. We have to make the workplace reflect us. I mean, even the sense of retirement. You know, why do you get to a certain age and you leave? You're just evolving, you know, and we have to start having the workplace reflect us. So the last thing I'll say is that a quote, and it's by a maker, Alice Walker, who's a wonderful novelist and wrote The Color Purple, became an amazing movie. But Alice Walker said years ago in one of her novels, "Whenever I've walked, a path has appeared. Whenever I've knocked, a door has opened." And I really think that the ability to be who you want to be is more in your control than you realize. And I think take advantage of the situations that are in front of you and make experiences happen for yourself. And you will be surprised, I think, at what welcome and open doors you are met with. So with that, I would love to hear more from some of you. And just for a protocol, I think it's easier if I take three questions at a time and then try to answer those as succinctly as I can, and then we'll get three more. So if people want to come, they can come up to the microphones. And like I said, if you're in the other room, you can write them down, and somebody will come, and you can raise your hand, and they'll collect them in the other room. I'm like, while people are getting up, here's somebody coming. It's always hard to be the first.
Okay, so when people are, like, demotivating you, or if there's guys in a certain environment, what's your motivator? Like, what keeps you going?
Well, I have to always, like, check the situation and feel like, how safe do I feel? I mean, and not safe, like, am I going to be hurt, but, like, am I going to be able to emotionally withstand the situation? And sometimes I just cave, you know. Sometimes I'm sort of like, the best response I can give now is no response and just walk away. And sometimes, you know, if I'm feeling safer, you know, I'll dare to say, you know, that's not fair. Why do you think that? Let's talk about that. And then if I'm feeling really, really brave, I turn it back on them. And here's an example, and this is a little bit crude. I will give you from the beginning. Years ago, I was out to lunch with this guy, and he ended up becoming, unfortunately, very successful, so it drives me nuts. But he was telling a joke, and the end of the joke was very homophobic, and he was talking about lesbians, and he said, well, they're just a bunch of rug munchers, was his term. And I looked at him and I said, but aren't you a rug muncher too? And And it stopped him. I know that's very... But sometimes you have to find when you can go back at the person with the thing and feel safe enough to do that. And he was talking about women that he worked with and being incredibly offensive. And I was like I said, he got the last laugh because he's so successful. But I think gauging your success. I mean, what I often try to do if I have more time with somebody is try to figure out what in them is acting that way. And I don't mean by, like, tell me about your family background. But I try to figure out in my own head, like, okay, you didn't go to Harvard, you're not that athletic. Like, what's the thing that maybe is making you act this way? And then I try to tap into that. The other thing that I try to do is I try to relate to them. Years ago, I was at a dinner and there was a man who worked for Smith Barney, who was a big investment firm. And he said, I work at Smith Barney. And he was clearly full of himself. And I was like, well, that's great. And he said, what do you do? And I said, well, tell me more about what you do at Smith Barney. And so I gave him tons of props. Like, I was sort of like, that's amazing you do that. That's so great. And I said, you know, I was actually at a meeting at Smith Barney the other day. Why were you at a meeting? Oh, because I was trying to create a social screen for investing that was through a human rights framework. You know, you have one on the environment at Smith Barney. And he said, oh, I didn't know we had that. And I said, yeah, and I was just trying to think of, could you gauge companies by how good they were to their employees from a human rights framework. And he was like, well, that's interesting. Why would you do that? And I was like, well, you know, if I have an endowment at my foundation and we're trying to figure out how to invest it. So I think I try to insert myself into their life a little bit more and then help make it make sense. I also try to get to get them to understand how their life might be easier, for instance, with feminism. You know, I'm often in, you know, well, you don't mean to get the door for you. Well, you can get the door for me if you're there first, you know, but wouldn't you like to not have the financial burden of your family? Wouldn't you like to not? And when you can sort of get somebody there, they get it a little bit more.
Thank you.
Yeah, can you come up to the microphone? Yeah. Just so other people in the other room can see you too.
We also have a question.
Oh, good. Okay, great.
Hi, I'm Lindsay from Quincy High School, and I was wondering if you've had any female mentors that have had a really big impact on your life and what you think about the value of mentorship.
I think mentorship is huge. I think mentorship is a two-way street, and I will say selfishly that I think I've given as much as I've gotten, and some of my earliest mentors were family related. You know, my mother was a huge inspiration, and my mother was 19 or 20 years old, and she had me. She didn't have a college degree. She went back to work first as a teacher, then got a graduate degree and got a better job and a better job. And I've never known my father. And so I watched, you know, a lot of my feminist sensibility is came later in life, but a lot of it was just, I never saw gender roles in my house. My mom just did it all. And that was an amazing example for me. I also have a godmother who worked her entire life and ran a store and was always creating schools, and she was always reinventing herself, and that was an amazing example for me. When I worked in the law firm, as I said, there were these two women, and I loved this one woman, Roberta Benjamin, and she had very powerful clients, like senators and head of Children's Hospital in Boston, and I would watch them call her and just say, Roberta, my refrigerator broke. Should I get a new one or should I not? And I was like, I can't believe you have this power over these people. They were so vulnerable. And she was so stoic and brave and just didn't take shit from anybody. And I love that ability of hers to, you know, she walked into the room with her fur coat and her cigarette and her gin in one hand, and she would just put people in their place. And I really took a lot from that. And I also, one of my closest friends is Gloria Steinem, who's been a big feminist, and Gloria's been an amazing role model to me and just made my life in many ways. You know, when I was starting Third Wave Foundation, I would say, oh, can you do this? And she'd be like, well, you can do it. You can do it. I actually was with Gloria 2 weeks ago when she got the Presidential Medal of Freedom at the White House. Like, Michelle was like two rows in front of me. And it was such a humbling experience because, I mean, there were many people on the stage, but I thought, you know, Gloria really did just give, does give over and over and over again. And so not only did she mentor me directly, but that example of, like, you don't ever retire, you don't ever stop, and really you just give out and it ultimately is going to come back to you. And then I'm constantly mentored and inspired by a lot of, because now as I get older, I need younger mentors to sort of like it just explained to me what's going on in life and what why you would ever want to tweet all day and why. So I have a lot of younger women who come to my feminist camps, and I really get constant inspiration and mentorship from them as well. I'm going to, if somebody else wants to come up, but I'm going to read a question from the next room, which is, what advice would you give to women who want to go into fields that aren't known as big money makers, for instance, acting, musician, and writers? And I would say you absolutely should, you know, money is important, especially when you have tons of student loans and when you have health insurance to pay and when you want to have shelter and food and transportation, and I don't want to ignore that. But I also think that it's an unfortunate consequence of this generation that I think the amount of money that we think we need, or more, the things we think we need, are so out of whack that I think we have to think about what does it mean to have a living, and what does that living require? And people, I have seen amazing artists. You know, I live on the Lower East Side of New York City, which is flooded with artists and musicians. I mean, like these types of people. And it's amazing to me that they're so passionate about their art and their craft and what they want to be doing in life, that they'll eat ramen every night to this day. You know, they don't need fancy clothes. They don't need vacations. They don't need, because they feel so firmly in what they want to do. And then I also think that there's creative ways where if you're a musician or an actor and that's not exactly paying the bills, then be a music teacher, you know, be an acting teacher, start an online platform, you know, help kids with cameras, you know, do, so there's other ways to cobble together income. And that's something that I will say, especially when you go into one of those professions, and this is true of my profession, is you will have three jobs. I mean, you will have three jobs at one time, and one of them will be going on auditions, and one of them will be teaching acting to kids, and one of them will be doing tutoring. You know, you will have that, and that is now a normal way of being. So let me go, you two, and then I'll go over here to you two.
Hi, I was wondering if, were you ever scared or felt like that you might not be able to do it? Because you seem very confident, like you seem like, although it was changing a lot what you wanted, you always were like driven to make it succeed, mm-hmm. But I was wondering if you were ever scared, and if you were, how did you get over that?
Oh my gosh, I am still scared. I get scared every day that, you know, I won't be able to pay my bills, that something will happen and I'll be evicted, you know, that my kids will get hurt and I won't be able to pay them. I mean, I get scared constantly. And, you know, part of the advantage of being able to make up your career is that you get to wake up every day and sort of say, what am I going to do today? The disadvantage is thinking like, oh wait, what if tomorrow doesn't happen the way today happened, and there's no money tomorrow, and there's no sustainability, and what if, you know, I hurt my hand and I can't type and I need to type all the time? So I did and I do still have tons and tons of fears. But, you know, and this is something that Gloria Steinem taught me, is she said, you know, it's so much harder not to. You know, and I think that the fear can definitely stop you, but I think once you do it, the fear of doing it is a fraction of the fear of just thinking about it. You know, you might stumble and fall, and failure is great. I mean, I was an athletic kid, and people say that they love working with athletes because athletes know that they can lose and then win. And I think that that is a great metaphor, that you know that you can fail one day and then you can succeed the next. Wait, I'll go here, and then I'll go you two and then over here so I can...
My question mainly pertains to feminism. So I know in my personal experience, I have, when I was younger, I struggled with intimidation factors and feeling inferior to men. Mm-hmm. And after attending a single-sex school, I've really become a feminist and embraced that. So I wanted to know what factors or instances in your life or in your adolescent life really influenced you into becoming a feminist activist?
Yeah, definitely. I'll take her question, then I'll answer just in case there's some overlap.
Hi, I'm Cindy.
Hi.
My question is, like, how did your career, because it was such an unusual profession, did it affect your personal life, like finding a partner, having friends, and all that?
Yeah, I mean, they're not unrelated. I mean, I think I was living a feminist life much sooner than I acknowledged I was living a feminist life. And by that, I mean that, you know, when I was, you know, 10, I was out babysitting and cleaning houses, and I was very aware of having my own money and my own income and my own support network, in part because I wanted like a Spree jeans or Calvin Klein jeans. My mother was like, no way, that's a waste of money. So it was a way for me to get what I wanted, and I saw that very early on. And it's funny, I have a sister-in-law who doesn't work, and she'll comment on something I'll have, and she'll say, and she does not work, in a four-pay job, and she'll say, "Oh, that's right, you have a job." And I always say back, I'm like, "Yeah, that's right, I have a job." So I do think that it taught me. So I think that early on, I saw the power of that. I also was I was on the girls' soccer team, and we would have to play in the boys' old uniforms, and we'd have to play on a field down the street. And I wasn't identifying it as feminism. I was like, that just feels unfair. Like, why do we have to go to the away games and watch the boys play, and then we play, and then they go shower and have lunch? I just think that's wrong. And their uniforms are twice as big, and why do we have to wear them? And they get new ones. You know, so I was raising things that later to me I realized were feminist. I also, in my high school, I was the first girl to run for head of school. And I made a big mistake because I ran entirely on my gender. My campaign tagline was, "It's time for a change," but the only change I gave was gender. And I realized that gender is not enough. You know, you needed to have a platform, and you needed to have things that you stood for besides your gender. And so that was an early misstep, I think, that I took. Leading into the next question, I feel I'm an only child. And so a friend's husband was arguing me the other day that he was going to have a second kid because only children aren't socialized properly. And I said, "Really? Tell me more about that." And he said, "Oh, no, they tend to not be able to make friends." And I said, "I see it the opposite. Because I didn't have siblings, I felt like I always had to arrive willing to, like, 'Hi, I'm Amy. I'll do whatever you want me to do to be your friend. And you want to play Barbie? I'll play Barbie. You want to do this? I'll do that.'" So I feel, you know, my friends are a really big part of my life. To this day. And I've always been in a relationship, you know, for literally like almost as long as from Tommy Navarro when I was in fourth grade. You know, I feel like I've been a little bit of a serial monogamist along the way. And I wouldn't ever say, I mean, it's funny. I have a friend who lives in Boston, and I have another friend that lives in Texas, and they're two of my childhood friends, and they both are my two friends that ended up in investment banking worlds. And still to this day are in investment banking worlds. And they're two friends who were the most resistant to my feminism. You know, when I would say, "Oh, will you come to this thing?" They'd say, "Oh, like your feminist thing? No thanks." And over time, they softened. Both of them have three children. Both of them, when they had their second child and went back to work, they both are also married to investment banker husbands, learned they had been passed over for a promotion, because the assumption is that you don't come back after your second baby when you're in that profession. And both of them, in their own way, called me after this experience and said, "I am going to stay working, and I'm going to have a third kid, and I'm going to keep working, because I don't want the assumption to be that women don't come back to work." So sometimes, even in your least likely friends, you will find these connections. And so it might not happen immediately, but over time, I think that many people come up against feminism, and they find a way to sort of signify that to you. And I will say that, you know, for me, feminism has been far more of an advantage in my life than a disadvantage. I mean, I do sometimes get to dinner parties, and I'm like, why does everybody else get to talk about the weather, and I have to talk about Hillary Clinton? Like, I do feel like I bring, like, that there's a second when you say you're the feminist, they're like, "Well, what do you think about this?" And you're like, "Ugh." But I do think that more often than not, then I get to go into rooms and say I'm a feminist, and people come up and hug me and thank me and, you know, stop me on the street. I mean, after Gloria got her medal, we flew back to New York together. People, like, from the janitor in the airport to the woman working at the Starbucks to this big corporate guy who was on the Calvin Klein board, all came up and said, "Thank you, Gloria. Thank you, thank you, thank you." And I don't get that level, but I do get so much. When you single yourself out as somebody who is caring about others and doing something for others, I think the praise you get far overrides the criticisms and the challenges that you get. Okay, over here to you two, and then I'll go.
Mine is actually pretty related to those, but I was wondering, you mentioned that when you say that you're an active feminist, it's more of a conversation stopper than a starter. So how do you think that we can sort of change the negative view that people have on feminism into something more positive?
Yeah. Can I get your question, and then we'll see if there's any overlap in them.
Hi, I'm Sophie. I was just wondering what your standpoint on the military was.
Sure. I mean, not unrelated. I feel like you have to, how I help myself in those situations is not unlike the Smith Barney guy, where I go and say, "Well, tell me a little bit about yourself." And then I try to find the moments for feminism in that conversation. I mean, for instance, I was at a doctor's appointment recently, and the form said married and not married. No, married and single. And this was 2 years ago. It was before gay marriage was passed in New York City. And I said to my doctor, who I don't ever have any political conversations, I said, "Why do you do this way? Why can't you just say married and not married?" I feel like it's really alienating to people who can't be married. And she says, oh, I never thought of that. You're right. We can change it to married and unmarried. And then I came back for my next appointment. And she says, you know, I told my husband that he should do that too, that we were, because her husband's a doctor. And he changed the forms in his office too. And so I think sometimes you just have to find, what I find is people's resistance to feminism is not a belief that people should have access to the same resources and information, but a misunderstanding about what it requires of us. And I think that sometimes the uncomfortable conversations I have are people thinking that when I say I'm a feminist, they think, oh, so you want men to stop being in power so women can be in power, and you want men to stop having privileges so women can have privileges. And what I'm really saying is I just want everybody to be able to be who they want to be, and I still think that there's far too many limitations on that. And I want to also say, because I think that so much of feminism and all social justice movements, the focus is on we want everybody to be able to rise to their potential, but we also have to stop letting people fall below their potential. And I think that that's where I see the biggest gender gap. It's not so much in women not being able to achieve, it's that when you look at who is stuck at the bottom because of the high cost of health insurance, because of such a low minimum wage, it's disproportionately women, it's disproportionately women of color, it's disproportionately women with children. And so it's not so much of like, I want feminism because I want more people to be at the top. I want feminism because I want there to be less of a single type of person that's at the bottom. You know, I want to even out that. So I think if I can make that clear to people, that's true. And women in the military, you know, I think my first instinct is that we should just not have a military, but I know that's not realistic. And I have had a great advantage over the last couple of years to meet a lot of women who've been in combat, and I have to say it is so profound to me that anybody would want to stand up for our country, and particularly women, because what they face, and men face the same levels of sexual violence that women do inside the military by their comrades, by their fellow military, but I think that what they are stepping into is a very uncomfortable situation, and the fact that they're doing it and doing it over and over again to me is very, very brave and amazing. You know, the big myth is that, you know, they redid so women can now be on the front lines of combat. And I say that's a myth because we don't have front lines anymore. I mean, I just went to Gettysburg. There were front lines, clearly, when we were in Gettysburg. But now the wars are all over. And so what this recent change in the military does is just acknowledge what's been happening for years. And, you know, there are subtle things that when you're on the front line, you get better pay. You get better access to savings, higher interest savings rates. You get better, you're allowed to have some mental disorders that other people in other ranks are not allowed to have. And so all this did was acknowledge something that had been happening forever. So I think that you know, as long as we have a military, it should be available to everybody. And the military comes with incredible, as much as it comes with a lot of burden, it comes with a lot of resources. And so why should women not be able to get access to those same resources? So I'll do two over here and then...
Good morning. My name is Rosa. I'm from Lawrence High. I seriously don't know how you do it. My heart's about to it's about to come out. But my question was, what is your best response to men who oppose what you stand for?
Yeah. I'll take her question now.
I have a similar question. How have you responded in the past when women have tried to tear you down?
Well, I was going to say that I actually have a harder time with women opposing me than men opposing me. And I think that the hardest thing about all opposition is I've been on Bill O'Reilly's show, I've had Rush Limbaugh take me down. That doesn't bother me because there's no way we're ever going to agree on most things in life, and I'm fine with that. I don't want to agree with Rush Limbaugh, and I don't want him to agree with me. And so I'm fine with those levels of challenges. What I think is the hardest for me is when people that I'm very close to will sort of say in a seemingly supportive but seemingly condescending way, like, oh, I think it's great that you're so PC, or I think it's great that you're doing such giving, you know, being so generous. And I feel like there's a little bit of a pat comment in that, and I think that's the hardest thing for me. And men not understanding feminism is, or challenging feminism is easier for me because I think they're trying to say, what's my place in it? And women challenging is harder for me because I feel like there's something in them that's not allowing them to see the benefit of feminism in their lives. And sometimes that's really deep-rooted and tough, and I want to be sympathetic to that. And sometimes it's societal stereotypes, and you have to get past that. And more often than not, what I say to both of them is, like, what are you scared of? Like, what are you scared of by calling yourself a feminist? Are you scared people are going to call you a lesbian? Are you scared people are going to think you don't like men? Are you scared? You know, what is it that you're really scared of? And often when you sort of throw that back to people, they're like, you're right. I don't know. But what people are scared of that I'm very sympathetic to is they're scared that it means they have to be an upstanding citizen all the time, that it means they can't have sexism or racism around them and not be speaking up. And I'm sympathetic to that. It's hard work, because I think when you acknowledge that you're a feminist, you're acknowledging that you're not only in it for yourself, but you're in it for others. Okay, I'm going to take these two questions, and then we're out of time. So I'll go over here and then here. Yeah, go. Oh, you can go first. It's okay. I'm thinking about this.
My questions is pretty similar to some of the ones I've already been asked. But in terms of ignorance, I think what I find with women who oppose feminism, it's like they think that what they have is enough, and they're like, we should just settle. So how do you go about helping women in like a way that they'll understand and feel comfortable with, see that what they have like isn't enough, and they should be fighting for more?
Yeah.
My question was that in life today, I feel like for women, it's all or nothing, that it's hard to juggle a lot. So mm-hmm. when you were younger growing up, how did you find juggling academics with sports and friendships and just not getting burnt out all the time and not being stressed out, and how you went from being the only girl to being in an environment where all girls and just fitting in and making everything work and clash mm-hmm. together?
Let me see if I can condense those two questions. I was a big classics major when I was in high school, and what many people remember about me is that no matter where we were, and we'd often be on our way to a party or on a sports game, is that I had flashcards with me constantly. Like, and so I do think that one of the things I've done my entire life, and this is still true of me today, is to combine it all into one. You know, and I'll take my kids to work things, you know, both because I don't want to be away from them sometimes, but also I want them to see what I do, and the best way to tell them what I do is to bring them into environments. And so whether it's the 16-year-old who had the Greek flashcards on the way to the party, or at the party even, or in the sports bus, or, you know, the 43-year-old who brings her kids places and who, again, figures out... I think it's just figuring out when you can be two things at once, you know, without overtaxing yourself. And I think that the, you know, for me, again, I have found feminism a far greater gift than I have a punishment. And getting people to understand feminism, I do think you have to understand. I think what we do too often is we overstate the problems that women still experience. Women are raped, women are sexually abused, women are, and I think all of those are very real problems and very tangible problems. But I also think that we have to point out the ways that women's advantage can help everybody. And I think that what women have shown is that they are much more sensitive to making their success a gateway for other people's successes, and making sure that they're changing systems and not only just achieving themselves. And I think that, you know, there's a great woman based here in Boston. This is the last point that I'll make, Robin Ely, and she went into companies and said that, you know, traditionally men are seen to be better salespeople because they make more calls and they don't talk as much as women. But when they went over time, they realized that women's clients came back over and over again. And I think that that's a good example for me, because we need to realize the ways that when we're saying we want women to succeed, it's women succeeding in a way that's going to benefit everyone. Everybody. And so thank you. I don't know if you have closing remarks, but we have to rush. But thank you all. And I will stick around up here if people have other questions.